This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Stephen Colbert is a fearless comic, but he took fearless to a new level when he brought the Colbert Report to Iraq earlier this month and did a week of programs there. Colbert's theater was one of Saddam Hussein's old palaces, which is now in Camp Victory. His theater audience was made up of American troops serving in Iraq.
It must be nice here in Iraq because I understand some of you keep coming back again and again and again. The nice thing, yeah, give it up for yourself. The good news is you've earned enough frequent flyer miles for a free ticket to Afghanistan.
Comedy Central's The Colbert Report became the first USO-sponsored comedy show recorded and broadcast entirely from a war zone. To tell us what it was like to do the show from Iraq is Colbert Report executive producer Allison Silverman. She's a former head writer for The Report and has been with the show since it debuted in the fall of 2005. She previously wrote for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and Late Night with Conan O'Brien. Allison Silverman, welcome to Fresh Air, and bravo. What an incredible week of shows you did. It was just so exciting to watch it. Whose idea was it to take the show to Iraq?
Well, you know, about a year ago, Bing West, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense, was on our show. And after the show ended, he gave Stephen a photograph that some troops had given him. And it's about 10 guys over in Iraq. And it says, Stephen, come on over. And that really got the idea in our minds. And we started working to make it happen.
You know, I remember I saw the show, the Stephen Colbert show, live when it was in Philadelphia during the presidential primaries last year. And there were so many technical difficulties because there was a live satellite feed with presidential candidate at the time, Obama. Mm-hmm. And so it was a fabulous show, but the audience knew that there were all kinds of delays and things were going wrong behind the scenes. You'd never know it watching the show. But when the show was over, I remember Stephen Colbert saying, I'm never taking the show on the road again. and then, okay, you're never taking the show on the road again, and now you're taking it to Iraq.
Right.
No way.
Well, right now he has on his door, on his notepad, Stephen has written, this is the last impossible thing we will ever do.
Was it important to you personally to do this?
It was. It became more so as we got closer to the date. And we had spoken to many times to Paul Rykoff, who founded the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans Association. He was giving us a real sense of how people feel over there and their, you know, how tough it is to be there, how lonely and how abandoned one sometimes feels. So we became very excited about putting on a show for those guys. And that actually became something that editorially was sometimes hard to figure out. You know, usually we have an audience in our studio that we assume and think is pretty much like our audience at home and is made up of people of many different career paths, but they're all here in the U.S. And this was very different. We had a studio audience that was quite different from our audience at home. And it became sometimes difficult to figure out, well, who are we pitching this show to? And does this joke go to the people in the room or does it go to the people who are watching at home?
You probably didn't even know if they were fans of the show. When somebody comes to see your show in New York at Comedy Central, they're coming because they're a fan. They want to be uh-huh. there. But in the military audience in Iraq, like you probably had no idea whether they even knew who Stephen Colbert was and if they knew about the persona that he portrays on the air and if they'd be in on the jokes.
Right. We definitely had been told by folks that the show was popular over there, but at the same time, I'm certain there were plenty of troops in the audience who hadn't seen it before, and that was interesting, yeah. We also had some concerns or challenges in Stephen's voice as the character, Stephen Colbert, and Stephen as a person. You know, it becomes tough sometimes when their feelings, their points of view overlap. A lot of times on the show, probably, you know, well into 80% of the time, Stephen Colbert, the character's view, is different than the view of Stephen Colbert, the person. But when you're doing something like doing a show for the troops and being happy to be there and having words of support for them, then both the character and the person think that. And it actually can become a little bit difficult because sometimes I think the audience, certainly me as a reader of scripts, assumes that what the script is saying is not what the voice of the show is really saying. And finding moments of earnestness and making clear that you're being earnest is surprisingly challenging sometimes.
So give us an example of how that was handled, the earnestness.
Well, I think that was part of our decision to do a number of jokes that were sort of an homage to Bob Hope, in a sense. Jokes that weren't as much coming from the view of a right-wing blowhard and more as, frankly, in the Bob Hope character, kind of cowardly. You know, both Stephen the character and Stephen the person could feel that way. We did a number of pieces where Stephen was working to do things that the military generally does and failing.
Let me play an example of that. There was a really funny sketch where, you know, Stephen Colbert goes into basic training so that he can, you know, be prepared for Iraq. And there's a really funny sketch with a drill sergeant. And let's play an excerpt of it. This is just like a few excerpts of that sketch. And so Stephen Colbert, like, shows up to report for basic training. And he's wearing his sunglasses. He's carrying a duffel bag. And he meets the drill sergeant. And here's what happens.
Stop! Take those glasses off! Who the hell you think you are? Take those glasses off!
Okay, I'm here for the Army. Is this the Army?
This is the Army. I'm your drill sergeant.
Okay, you're the guy in charge?
I am in charge. You follow me. I lead, you follow.
Okay, I'm going to need a bellman because I have a couple more bags in the car.
Pick it up. Follow me.
Okay, I'm just going to grab my chapstick. I'll be right back.
Let's go.
So there's chapstick inside?
There is chapstick for you inside. You will get out of that uniform and get to this uniform.
Okay, thank you.
Five. Four.
Do you have this in the next size up?
Put it on.
These are just a little snug in the crotch.
Now, you are a private. Right now, you're a just best drill sergeant. Do you understand?
Yes.
Drill sergeant.
I understand.
Drill sergeant.
I heard you the first time.
Drill sergeant.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Drill sergeant.
Am I the drill sergeant? I thought I was the private.
I'm the drill sergeant.
Yes.
Drill sergeant.
I agree.
Get down and knock out 10 push-ups.
You get more flies with honey than you...
Get down and knock out 10 push-ups.
Okay.
That's Stephen Colbert in Iraq. My guest is Alison Silverman, who is an executive producer of the show. That's such a funny sketch. And was that a real drill sergeant? And if so, how did you find, like, the right drill sergeant for your sketch?
Well, I have to give a lot of credit to our field team there who did work and you know, we thought we had a good guy, and then we went down there and discovered he was just perfect. I mean, one of the lines you just played is my favorite, which he says, "Yes, there is chapstick inside."
Is that improvised?
It was improvised. Yeah, absolutely. We definitely needed to have a number of Rolands, we call them, available to put in the show. Each of the shows had a weighty chunk that was pre-recorded because we couldn't bring many people over to Iraq. We were working with, you know, about a third of our general crew, and there was just no way to produce a lot of material there.
You know, you talked earlier about having the Colbert character be like Bob Hope, because Bob Hope did so many USO tours during the course of his career. And, you know, a couple of the most obvious similarities is Colbert had, you know, a golf club slung across his shoulder, Bob Hope style. But I was wondering, you know, would the troops even get the reference? Because they're too young to have watched the Bob Hope USO shows.
You know, when we said on our fourth show, we called out that it was an homage to Bob Hope, the audience went crazy. I think that they did know. A large portion of them knew. I mean, he did those shows for, I think, about 50 years. So I also anticipated that it might not be something that people would get. But hopefully the material made them laugh if they didn't get it. And a fair number of them did.
And Colbert was wearing, you know, a suit. and tie, but the suit was camouflage. So, I mean, that in itself was really funny. Who made it for him?
The suit, the Digicam suit, was made by Brooks Brothers.
Oh, that's great. Maybe they'll start making it available to everybody.
I thought it was very smart.
Very smart. The first night from Iraq, General Ray Odierno was the guest. And President Obama made a surprise visit via video. And I just want to play an excerpt of that bit. So this is from the first night that the Colbert Report was in Iraq. And it starts with General Odierno speaking.
Stephen, if you want to do this right, you're going to have to get your hair cut.
But without my hair, wait a second. Without my hair, what would I blow dry?
Stephen, you got to cut it off.
With all due respect, sir, you're not the best advertisement for a haircut. And frankly, sir, it is going to take more than a four-star general to get me to cut my hair. Jimmy, what's going on?
Excuse me, General?
Mr. President, welcome, sir.
Thank you, General. First, I want to send my greetings to the men and women of our armed forces in Iraq. And I and all Americans thank you for your service.
You're welcome, Mr. President.
I wasn't talking to you. Now, second, General, I overheard your conversation about Stephen's hair.
Wait a second. You overheard? Are your spy satellites really that good?
No, but my ears are really that big. Now, as a man who understands the appeal of a close crop, I say if Stephen Colbert wants to play soldier, it's time to cut that man's hair.
Wait a second.
Sir, is that an order?
General, as the commander-in-chief, I hereby order you to shave that man's head.
Yes, sir, Mr. President.
Hold on.
Thank you, General. And once again, my thanks to everybody over there.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Okay, that's from the first night that the Colbert Report was in Baghdad. And my guest, Alison Silverman, is an executive producer of the show. And I know that you were in the White House when that sketch was recorded because there's a clip circulating of the sketch being recorded on the Internet. It must have been just kind of amazing to be in the Oval Office with the president shooting a comedy sketch.
It was actually in the library.
Oh, excuse me. Okay.
Yeah. It was wonderfully strange. You know, there were a couple of copies around. Someone on the crew had brought a copy of our book, I'm America and So Can You, which we snuck onto the bookshelf before we left. And always I have scripts in hand and I'm scribbling all over them. And shortly before the president came in, I was scribbling on this desk and someone very politely came over to me and told me that desk was probably not the best place to be making my mark. I'm sure it was used at all kinds of historic occasions.
So did Obama get it in one take?
He did. We asked for two, mainly because one thing that was certainly hard and we wound up cleaning it up in edit was timing, you know, trying to figure out how we do this without having to cut away from the president more than necessary and yet allowing for the cheers of the troops. So the double takes were mostly just to change the amount of time in between his lines. And it was at 6:30. And one of the things I love, actually, is that we got some pictures from Pete Souza, the White House photographer, and they're all tagged with what happened that day. So there's a picture of me shaking hands with President Obama, and the bottom it says, President Barack Obama meets with Mahmoud Abbas.
So Stephen Colbert got his hair shaved to a crew cut, and General Odierno looks like he's shaving his head, Colbert's head, but you can see no hair's really coming off. So I assume like a genuine barber or stylist actually shaved it in the break.
Well, you know, he actually did shave Stephen's head.
The general?
That first swipe is absolutely for real. Now, Stephen not only has a very lush head of hair, but it is well shellacked for those shows. So it was just very difficult to get it to really be coming off. We'd actually practiced in the writer's office earlier with one of our writers, Barry Julian, who sat down and we had the general shave his head, and then the general gave him an award of excellence for his, for volunteering. And Barry is Canadian. The one of us who agreed to be the example is actually Canadian. So he is absolutely really shaving it. It's just it takes a lot to get that hair off of Stephen. So during the break between what we call X3 and X4, we had the job finished by Carrie Plant Price, who is works with the show, and we did it in front of the troops, which was a lot of fun.
What are some of the things the show had to deal with in moving for a week to a combat zone?
Well, to begin with, there were only a certain number of people who could come. We have a kind of a tough enough time getting the show up at a reasonable hour every day with a full staff, and we could only bring about a third of our people over. So, for instance, from a writing standpoint, while we were in Iraq, me and a number of folks and about four of our writers, the other writers were here in New York working the night shift. They came in around 3 a.m., worked till 11 a.m., so we could get in contact with them and be asking for various content jokes to be generated. There was all kinds of issues, of course, with this space. We were in the Alpha Palace. If you've seen it, it's just a enormous, enormous space where everything is marble. I went around a little bit on my own, and I found air conditioner vents that were marble, just 2-inch slats of marble. It's, you know, as one would expect, insane. And for me, I thought that our sound guys had perhaps the most difficult job. They're working in a circular space with pillars that is, gosh, I don't know, 150 feet tall. I mean, that's ridiculous. I have no idea how tall it was, but it was plenty tall, and all marble. So we were struggling with various like materials that we were draping in places so that the sound would stay in one place and not bounce all over the place. And that was, it was sometimes difficult. I think that we achieved all that we could hope for, but there were things that were tough. You know, one of the things that you may see when you're watching the shows at home is that things that are visual in terms of those roll-in pieces, things that are visual are getting the biggest laughs, I think, often because it was just super hard to work against the space in terms of hearing things. There were also things like just in terms of infrastructure, for instance, in the writers' rooms, our normal software that we use for writing scripts, we couldn't network together over there. So it was sort of pointless to be using the software that depends on networking, and we were just running around with one another, just giving each other scripts on little USB sticks, memory sticks, and you know, all hooked up to one single printer, one tiny little printer, and one person who could print. And the first night of the show, of course, everything is going surprisingly well. 20 minutes to air, and that printer dies. And the whole show went up, you know, quite a bit late. And the scripts that we wound up with were handwritten, the changes from the rehearsal script to the final script, because one little port to one little printer wasn't working. One of the things that was both enjoyable and a challenge was the we were working, Stephen and I and the writers, in the television studio, which is in a trailer, the Alpha Palace. And there were lots of guys in there and women, military folks working and doing their various jobs. But the phone for the television studio was programmed to ring with the Batman theme from the 60s. So you'd be trying to work on a joke, and then all of a sudden you would hear da na 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 na. And I can't imagine a melody that will wipe your slate clean faster than that. It was It was very, very hard. I'm surprised we didn't have more Adam West jokes in the show, considering.
You were talking before about the difficulty of coming up with sketches where the Colbert character and Stephen Colbert himself would agree on something. And here's an example of a sketch where they kind of did and kind of didn't agree. Colbert does this, like, one of his recurring sketches is called Formidable Opponent, in which there's two Stephen Colberts on camera and they debate each other because only Stephen Colbert is good enough to be a formidable opponent to Stephen Colbert. He did a Formidable Opponent debate on gays in the military and Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And, you know, I think viewers of the show would assume that Stephen Colbert is solidly behind gay equality. But his character is not. But since it was a debate, both sides were represented. I thought it was really interesting that you would choose that subject for a sketch. And did you have any idea how it would go over? And did you have any idea how people in the audience would feel about Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
Well, that's absolutely the question that was going through our minds. And we, you know, we've wanted to do a Formidable Opponent on Don't Ask, Don't Tell for a while. This is one of the things when we went to Iraq, we said, this, you know, this piece has got to happen. Or we really, really want it to happen. You know, we had a hunch, and certainly from talking again to Paul Rykoff and various other members, former members of the military, that the troops would laugh at this, that they would be behind it, and that they'd see the humor in the policy. And it felt exciting to us to actually have people in America see the troops laughing at the inconsistencies of the policy. That is definitely something where the idea of our audience there and our audience in America, I felt like, worked really to our advantage. In our minds, it felt special to show that the military, certainly certain members of the military, can laugh at the rationale for this policy.
So you thought the audience was behind you?
I did. I mean, I do think that we presented two sides to the argument, and I certainly am sure that there were some members of the audience who saw the other side. But we got plenty of laughs off the idea that people who've been discharged from the military, who are decorated men and women, got all their medals before they were gay. And they became gay officially when they announced that they were gay. And who knows how they would perform after it was announced that they were gay? Obviously, they wouldn't be they wouldn't be so decorated.
Why don't we hear an excerpt of the Formidable Opponent Don't Ask, Don't Tell sketch? And this is from the Colbert Report in Iraq.
Are you nervous about visiting Iraq? Nope. I feel perfectly safe. I actually bought a gun from a local. That's a muffler. Yeah, little mix-up there. My Arabic translator was kicked out under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Another Arabic translator? That makes 59 in the last 5 years. Hey, that's the way the military career crumbles. I'm not happy about it, but it's not my responsibility, and it's not the military's responsibility. It is Washington's responsibility. This is a political decision. Yeah, but in the meantime, people like Lieutenant Colonel Victor Fehrenbach are being discharged after serving 18 years in the Air Force, even though he has 9 air medals, including one for valor. Yeah, but he got those medals before he was gay. We have no idea how he would fly now. Well, the idea that openly gay service members hurts morale makes no sense to me. Oh, it makes no sense to you. I'm sorry, have you served in the military? No, but I've been to Camp Victory. Hey, I've been to the circus, but I don't tell bears how to ride bikes. The military depends on unit cohesiveness and maintaining focus on the mission. But how would someone being gay affect that? Like this. Imagine one of us is gay. Which one? It doesn't matter. It matters to my wife. Oh, how is your wife? I'm sure she's fine. I asked a friend of mine to look after her. Do you know Jody? Oh, yeah. He's a great guy. Anyway, the point is, one of us is gay and problem solved. What problem? I don't know. Do you have a problem? What are you asking me? I'm not asking you anything. Are you telling me something? No? Good. Good. See how cohesive we are now? All because I don't know that you're gay. I'm not gay. Don't tell me.
That's Stephen Colbert versus Stephen Colbert on an edition of the Colbert Report from Iraq. My guest, Allison Silverman, is an executive producer of the show. Another sketch I want to ask you about, you know, you were talking earlier about how one of the things that Colbert, that you figured Colbert would do would be to kind of play the Bob Hope cowardly fish out of water kind of character. And so one of the things Colbert did was like go up with the with one of the Thunderbirds, those planes that mm-hmm. do jets that do the fancy aerobic air shows. And they, you know, they twirl around and do these incredible things in the air. And of course, you know, Colbert goes in looking like real macho, and then he's like throwing up while he's on the plane and looks really shaken when he gets off. What really happened during that flight?
You know, I believe that that is a fairly accurate document of what happened. He definitely threw up. He definitely felt pretty sick afterwards. You know, knew that that would probably be the case. I mean, before he goes up, you see him chugging a big gulp and eating chili. So we definitely had in our minds that vomit might be the natural extension of this game.
So had you planned out that when he kind of gets out of the jet, he'd be holding up one and then a second bag of his own vomit?
No. We had those high expectations.
So that was improvised. Very clever.
Yes, absolutely.
Making the best out of the worst.
Yeah.
One of the things that amazed me is that after doing a week of shows in Iraq, which had to be nerve-wracking and exhausting, you came back and with new shows the following week. I was expecting a week of reruns. Why didn't you take a few days off?
You know, that's just the way the schedule was and had been worked out to be. You know, we do get a number of weeks off over the course of the year, and this just wasn't one of them. It's been, I won't hedge, it was very hard last week. But, you know, we just, it was fun to be home. I have to tell you that that's been a lot of fun as well.
Well, it sounds like doing the Colbert Report has always been difficult. When I interviewed Stephen Colbert back in December of 2005, and this was just like a couple of months after the show got started, he was talking about, we were talking about how hard it is to keep the show going. And I just want to play an excerpt of that for you. Here it is. This is Stephen Colbert on Fresh Air in December 2005. You seem to be enjoying the show so much. But stepping back from that, I think it must be really like a lot of work to carry that.
It is a lot of work, but I'm not complaining because, you know, all a performer wants is to perform more. Now, we need to figure out a way to do it that's humane for the people who work on the show. I mean, right now, I have two wonderful head writers, Rich Dom and Allison Silverman, and Allison stayed up till 4 o'clock last night working on tonight's show.
Right.
And actually working on tomorrow's show. And so right now it's a little bit like a forced march to get the show done every day because we're essentially writing we have a guest who's there for maybe 5 or 6 minutes, but even that is a prepared moment, not for the guest, but for me because I have to establish what my character's take is on that person's work or on their writing or what they represent. You know, if we have somebody like iconic on, like Leslie Stahl from like the mainstream media. So it ends up being like a 22-minute monologue we're writing every night. And I think probably that's an unsustainable level of script output. And, you know, we're finding different ways to, you know, push away from me. And but it's a slow process.
So that's Stephen Colbert in December of 2005. And here we are in June of 2009. And Allison Silverman, seems to me like you're still putting out an unsustainable level of writing. Stephen Colbert made it seem like you were going to try to find ways of working in things that didn't depend so much on writing. But the show is still so writing heavy and incredibly funny. So what have you done to keep up what is an unsustainable level of work?
Well, you know, I'm so glad you played that clip because I did not stay up till 4 a.m. this morning. And I have very quantitative progress now that I can tell. You know, what Stephen said there is, in many ways, remains the case. There is this added angle to our jokes, obviously, of what does Stephen's character think? And that makes things, you know, it's an extra level. And I often sort of think of it in terms of driving on the highway in reverse by looking in your rearview mirror. Because to determine what you want to say and then back into how the character then his view on it, or the opposite, you know, sometimes we find out what the character wants to say and discover what we want to say through it, is very hard. In terms of making it more sustainable, we do have a bigger team than we did back in 2005, considerably bigger. And some really, really, really talented people have joined up and have really helped us along. It still remains a challenge. It'll always be a challenge. But I also think that what Stephen said in that clip, that he's not complaining, is also very true. I think that part of what inspires us to an extent is the difficulty of it. And that may make us very sick people, but we enjoy the challenge, I think, to a pathological extent.
No, before you worked on the Colbert Report, you worked on Jon Stewart's show.
Mm-hmm.
And how does writing for Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert compare?
Well, writing for The Daily Show, it was you know, almost 10 years ago that I was doing it, and the show has, you know, changed a lot since I was there. I found it really just fantastic in terms of finding point of view. That was always what was requested of us. Figure out what you think about a story. What is at the heart of a story, and find your joke off of that, which was just, you know, helped my writing tremendously, and is obviously what's part of what's made that show so successful. One of the things I definitely remember from there is I started in early 2000, and we went through the crazy election of 2000. And then I remember people saying to me, how is this show and how are you ever going to find presidential humor now that Bill Clinton is out of office? How will anyone ever have something funny to say about President Bush? I remember that being asked all the time, which I try to remember whenever people say to me, how do you find humor in Obama administration?
That's really funny. Some people think that it's rare to have women writers in comedy. Was that ever an obstacle for you? I mean, obviously you've done great. And I think certainly the people who you've written for, Conan O'Brien, Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, these are people who do not strike me as being sexist. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. You know, if anybody's going to have, you know, a really like open and enlightened writer's room, you'd think it would be them. So was it ever an obstacle?
I have not found it to be an obstacle. You know, now that I'm in a position where I look at submissions, I would definitely say that there are very few women who submit to these shows, and they have as good a percentage of people who get hired, I think, as our male submissions. So I would really like more women to apply for them, and I think perhaps part of that lack of submissions is due to this general feel that writers' rooms are very sexist, that you're going to be harassed, that it's, an old boys' network of its own sort, and that, generally you're going to be treated hostily. So I always want to get out there that I haven't had that experience at all, because, you know, maybe that's the way to solve whatever problem there is here. Just get more women to write. I haven't found anyone in my comedy travels who honestly thinks that women are not as capable of this as men are. I really don't think I have.
I want to get back to a recent show. Last Thursday's show, continued a sketch that was started earlier in the week about Obama swatting the fly. And, you know, this was about how, like, Obama had been talking about how there's one network that's completely devoted to, like, criticizing him. So it's hard for him to understand that people think he's getting, like, an easy ride in the media. So Colbert did this whole sketch for 2 days, exclusive coverage of murder in the White House, like the story of Obama killing an innocent fly and the repercussions on the fly's family. And there's many people in the fly's family, of course, because flies reproduce so quickly. Can you talk about, like, generating that idea and how that idea kind of evolved to the point where, like, Jeff Goldblum, who starred in the remake of The Fly, was on talking about flies?
Well, the generation of that idea, I think, goes back. We've got a lot of people on our staff who have an improv background, and sort of famously, a famous phrase of improv is yes and, that you agree to something that's been initiated and you take the next step. And I think that that played a big part. You know, we, in our pitch session that morning, we both had stories pitched about the president saying that there was a network that was devoted exclusively to his demise, and the story about the fly swatting. And we started to realize that they could be one of the same if we kind of had two turns in the piece. If we first had Stephen upset with the president for saying this and deciding that he was going to give the president some positive coverage, and then a turn where you discover the positive coverage is the fact that the president swatted a fly with such skill. And the only thing positive that Stephen can possibly say about him is that he managed to swat this fly so masterfully. And then to turn again back into extraordinarily negative coverage by talking about the fly family in mourning. And then, of course, we had to get a wrangler to bring us a jar full of flies. It's very—you have to be very careful. So we had these flies, and we couldn't let them out, certainly. We couldn't spray anything around them that could possibly injure the flies. And then Jeff Goldblum, that became, again, sort of a yes-and moment. Like, well, where else does a fly story go? Who else feels strongly about the rights of flies? That obviously takes you to Mr. Goldblum.
That's great. Allison Silverman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Allison Silverman is an executive producer of The Colbert Report and a former head writer. The Colbert Show broadcast from Iraq the week of June 8th. You can still see the shows on the Comedy Central website.
Nation, I am back from my tour in Iraq. Woo! You know, folks, I cannot believe that I am finally home. That was, without a doubt, the toughest, longest 5 days of my life. You know what? Make that 7 days. I spent 2 days on a plane, and the fully reclining 78-inch sleeper seat did not have memory foam. Wow. Everything seems so different now that I've been to war. I've witnessed shriveled husks of broken men suffering an unbelievable heat. I will never forget you, staff of Camp Victory's Cinnabon. Semper Frosting, guys. Now, after you've been to war, the rest of the world seems so trivial. I mean, who cares that Adam Lambert came out of the closet? Oh, my God, no way! No way!
The Cincinnati, Ohio quartet called Wussy has just released its third album called Wussy. Comprised of two men and two women, Wussy is led by its singer-songwriters Chuck Cleaver and Lisa Walker. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
It's All Right, We've Got All Night, Chuck Cleaver and Lisa Walker sing on that song, Little Paper Birds, the lead-off cut of their album, Wussy. And indeed, in their measured ways, Wussy's songs do exude a serene confidence in the strength of the music. It conveys the delicacy, the fragility of the emotions they want to describe. It also helps that Little Paper Birds includes a line that the band must have known would charm anyone who still uses the postal system. Quote, "I finally got your letter, and your punctuation hit me like a truck." Wussy certainly knows how to turn a phrase. On Gone Missing, Lisa Walker sings, "Now my heart is on my sleeve, or what's left of it." What does the "it" refer to? Her sleeve? Her heart? The latter is more poetic. On the other hand, Wussy music strives to avoid easy poetry, going for something more conversational, yet striving for a quality of open-ended elusiveness that more difficult poetry achieves. The band is also more than capable of coming up with a catchy up-tempo chorus, as they do on the otherwise bleak "Happiness Bleed." I remember puking down the side of the car, the cost of drinking liquor from the mouth of a jar, leaning on the fender and declaring that we name a star. Trapping through the brambles till our pants were all torn, searching for a paper bag of mildew porn, reflecting on the never-ending question why had we. Happiness bleeds, happiness bleeds, happiness bleeds. You and me. I remember stumbling down. You can listen to Wussy as a concept album propelled forward by the band's buzzsaw guitar riffs and tight little rhythm section. Cleaver and Walker write most of the songs and either alternate lead vocals or sing them in harmony. And the album itself becomes a short story about two people in a complicated relationship. Cut paper snowflakes hang down from the ceiling. The bathwater ripples predicting an earthquake. An air bubble surfaces rising to heaven. Some call this living, but I call this living life. Dreadful sorry. Dreadful sorry. Dreadful sorry. Dreadful sorry. Granddaddy long legs is climbing. If the album begins with the sentiment "we've got all night," as the collection progresses, the emotions become more mixed. Well, actually, more morose and fatalistic. The song I just played, Dreadful Sorry, comes about midway through this lengthy dissection of a couple about to split. Over increasingly louder, chiming guitars, with Cleaver and Walker raising their voices to be heard and to convey tension, they sing as one, "Some call this living, but I call this living alone." Uh-oh. By the climax of the album, the narrator of Death by Misadventure finds a note on the door saying, "Go away, I'm sleeping." "And so I leave," the lyric goes on, "but I believe that you're entertaining someone else." It's an almost elegant way to describe a betrayal, a final conclusion. It also works as a serious pun. The someone else that music is entertaining, as morose as it is full of life, is us. The very next song is called This Will Not End Well. Well, maybe not for Wussy, but it does for us.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.